Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this audio Psalms 129. I will entitle this psalm, My Soul Waits for the Lord. The title of the song is simply a song of ascents. That's A-S-C-E-N-T-S, going up. Four options as to what ascents means from the NIV Study Bible. Option number one, the psalm is sung to music that went up in pitch. It ascended in pitch. I'm not really fond of that option. Here's option number two. The ascent refers to the steps of the Jews returning from captivity from Babylon. As they walk to Jerusalem, they have to go up because Jerusalem is on a mountain. And they were singing the psalm as they returned. And so this is a song of ascents. That's reasonable. Here's option number three. The psalm was sung as a song by the Levitical singers, whose duty it was to perform worship in the temple. And as these singers walked up the steps of the temple, they would be singing this psalm. So it would be called a psalm of ascents. That's reasonable also. Here's option number four. The ascents refers to the steps of a pilgrim coming up to Jerusalem singing this psalm at one of the three legally required feasts that all the men of Israel had to go up to. Passover in the spring, Feast of Weeks in the summer, and Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. And they would sing this psalm and the other psalms of ascents as they came up to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is up on a hill, and so they would ascend as they sing. That's Adam Clark's view. It's got questions.org view. I think that's most people's view, although it's not really clear. Now, this song of ascents is the 10th of 15 psalms that have song of ascents in the heading. Namely, Psalms 122, Psalms 134. David was the author of four of those songs of ascents. Solomon was the author of one, and 10 of them are anonymous. And this is one of the anonymous psalms of ascents, so we don't know who the psalmist is. I will just refer to him as the psalmist. So we begin now in verses 1 through 4. The psalmist says this, "Many times they have persecuted me from my youth up." Let Israel now say, many times they have persecuted me from my youth up, yet they have not prevailed against me. The plowers plowed upon my back. They lengthened their furrows. The Lord is righteous. He has cut in two the cords of the wicked. Now they who have been persecuting the psalmist from his youth are not explicitly mentioned as to who they were. The NIV Study Bible says we cannot be sure who the persecutors were because it is not known when the psalm was written. And we also don't know who the author was. The NIV Study Bible, as well as John Gill, say that it could refer generically to all the persecution Israel had suffered during its entire history, all the way from Egypt to Babylon, from the exodus from Egypt to the exile to Babylon in 586 BC. So it doesn't really matter. The point is that Israel has been persecuted. Not only the psalmist has been persecuted from his youth up, but Israel in verse 2 says the same thing. Many times they have persecuted me from my youth up. The youth of Israel would probably be from Egypt, when Egypt was persecuting Israel, to Babylon, when Babylon persecuted Israel in 586 BC. Not to mention the fact that the 10 northern tribes got wiped out by Assyria in 722 BC. So both the psalmist and Israel have been persecuted for a long, long time. Yet they have not prevailed against me, says Israel. In verse 2, notice the repetition. Verse 1, many times they've persecuted me, says the psalmist. In verse 2, many times they have persecuted me, says Israel. The emphasis on persecution makes the point clear. Now, the enemies have not prevailed against Israel. How do we know that? Well, the Egyptians tried to wipe Israel out, and they failed. The Assyrians, after they tried to, well, they did actually defeat Israel in 722 BC, and they carried them out into exile, but they didn't destroy the physical race of the Jews. The Babylonians tried to destroy the race of the Jews, and they didn't do it. The Romans tried to destroy the Jews in AD 70, but they didn't do it. Jews are still here today. And John Gill adds the point that spiritual Israel still flourishes today in the church. The psalmist continues in verse 3, the plowers plowed upon my back. Now, what does that mean? There are a couple of ways one could look at this. The easiest way is to just picture the enemies of Israel plowing furrows on Israel's back. And that's the way I take it. And of course, if you were an individual having a furrow plowed upon your back, it would be most unpleasant. It would be torturous. Now, Adam Clark, following Jerome, the famous Catholic exegete and Bible translator, Jerome, the translator of the Vulgate, the Roman Catholic Bible, they say that what is referred to here is that the enemies of the Israelites literally plowed the fields using Israelites as oxen. So it would read this way, the plowers plowed upon my back because the ropes tying the plows to the horsepower, if you will, to the Israelites pulling the plow, those ropes were upon the back of the Israelite as he pulled the plow. So the plows would be plowing upon the back of the Israelites. Interesting idea, but it's not as immediately clear to me as just saying that the plowers plowed upon the backs of the Israelites. Also, we have to look at verse 3. Is it referring to the plowers plowed upon the back of Israel, or is it the plowers plowing upon the back of the psalmist? I don't think you can really tell. The New American Standard Bible has verse 3, the plowers plowed upon my back, in quotation marks, which refers back to verse 2 when it says, let Israel now say. And so the way they interpret it is verse 3 is Israel is saying, let the plowers plow on my back. And so verse 3 is stating that Israel is saying, the plowers plowed upon my back. I don't think it really matters. The psalmist is quite identified with Israel. In verse 4, the psalmist says, the Lord is righteous. He has cut in two the cords of the wicked. What are those cords? Option number 1, cords fastening the plow to the oxen. Those same oxen that were metaphorically pulling the plows up and down Israel's back. So God cut those cords so there would be no more plowing on Israel's back. Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown suggest that solution, and I think they're probably right. John Gill also suggests another idea. The cords that were broken were whips that were used to whip Israel. And here's my idea. The cords could be the cords that were used to bind Israel as a prisoner. They were cut so that the Israelites were no longer prisoners. I don't think we can ascertain what exactly the psalmist meant, so I report that one. You can decide it. We go down to Psalms 129, verses 5 through 8. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turned backward. Let them be like grass upon the housetops, which withers before it grows up, with which the reaper does not fill his hand, or the binder of sheaves his bosom. Nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. A little bit of imprecation here from the psalmist, which is all right. Nothing wrong with crying out for justice to God. May all those who hate Zion are being referred to here, those same people who are plowing on the backs of Israel. The word Zion in the Old Testament has both literal and figurative uses. It can refer physically to the city of David, that piece of land that stretches north to south and splits the two valleys, the Tarpeian Valley on the west and the Kidron Valley on the east, and reaches all the way down to the Hinnom Valley on the south. That's the city of David, referred to as Zion, but also sometimes Zion can refer to that city of David plus Mount Moriah, which is a flat, level plain to the north and northwest a little bit of the city of David. So those two areas both can be referred to by the term Zion or Mount Zion. Sometimes Mount Zion refers to the whole city of Jerusalem, which includes the areas to the west, and sometimes Zion refers to the whole land of Israel. The term Zion not only has physical uses, but can also be used figuratively to apply to those who believe in God. That's in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. Hebrews 12:22 says this, instead you Christians that the author of Hebrews was writing to, instead you have come to Mount Zion, that's the church, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, that's the church. So Mount Zion refers to the believers in the New Testament. So may all who hate Zion, and we can apply this to the New Testament. It doesn't refer to the New Testament here because the psalmist didn't know what the New Testament was, but we can apply it to all who hate the church, be put to shame and turn backward. Nothing wrong with praying that, and boy, there are plenty of people out there today who hate the church. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turn backward. Why backward? So they can't carry out their plans. They'll have to go the other way. Verse 6, the psalmist says, let them be like grass upon the housetops. Now, why would you want your enemies to be like grass upon the housetops? Before I discuss what the metaphor means, grass on the housetops, let's go back to the idea that the psalmist is imprecating his enemies here, which he is. He says in verse 5, let them be put to shame, let them turn backwards, let them be like grass on the housetops. The NIV Study Bible says these words, quote, sound spiteful and retaliatory. But then the NIV Study Bible goes on to say, not if you look at it as the psalmist being a plaintiff asking for God's justice in court. Does a judge who condemns a cold-blooded murderer to death sound spiteful and retaliatory? Well, of course not. Only modern people who have forgotten what God's justice means will think this sounds spiteful and retaliatory. Now let's return to this metaphor. Let them be like grass upon the housetop, which withers before it grows up. Verse 6. That means the grass was exposed to the full heat of the sun up on those flat tops in Israel, and it can't grow. It's too hot up there. And also, as Albert Barnes says, the housetops or roofs of houses covered with sand or earth in which seeds of grass may germinate and begin to grow, but where, as there is no depth of earth, and as the heat of the sun there would be intense, it would soon wither away. Isaiah uses the same metaphor of grass withering on a roof in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 27. Therefore their inhabitants were short of strength. They were dismayed and put to shame. They were as the vegetation of the field and as the green herb, as grass on the housetops is scorched before it is grown up. Isaiah is here speaking concerning Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and Isaiah is basically saying Sennacherib is going to get scorched. In verse 7, the psalmist, in referring to the aforesaid grass, says this, with which the reaper does not fill his hand. Well, that's because the grass never grows up enough so that the reaper can cut it like hay and fill his hand with it, because it never grows up. At the end of verse 7, the psalmist says the binder of sheaves never fills his bosom with it, because there's never enough grass to make a sheath with which the reaper can put in his bosom. So, in other words, the psalmist is saying, may the enemy of Zion be toasted, scorched by the sun, never coming to a full harvest, so to speak. And verse 8, the psalmist concludes by saying this, nor do those who pass by say, the blessing of the Lord be upon you. We bless you in the name of the Lord. Now, as Gill and Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all say, that passers-by would often bless workers in the field. Clark says this, quote, we find that it was customary when the master came to them into the field to say unto the reapers, the Lord be with you, and for them to answer, the Lord bless thee. Clark quotes Ruth 2:4 to back him up. Ruth 2:4 says this, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. So I'm pretty sure this is what the psalmist was referring to, a custom in Israel, but there's not going to be any harvest. There's not going to be any workers working in the field because there's no grass. It's all got withered up. In other words, there's not going to be any fruit for the enemies of Israel. And on that happy note, we are now finished Psalms 129. We are now prepared to go to the last psalm of ascents, Psalm 130. We will do that in the next audio, and I will call it My Soul Waits for the Lord. I hope you stay tuned for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this one.